So we're happy to have as our speaker today, Professor Vedika Kimani from Stanford University. So Vedika has done a lot of very influential work, especially in the field of quantum dynamics, in particular in many body localization, time crystals, and much more. Recently, she's been doing a lot of interesting work in the non-unitary frontier, and I think that'll be the subject of her talk today. So Vedika, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. Thanks very much, Tim, for putting together this really nice seminar series and for inviting me. I must confess that the time on the West Coast feels like the crack of dawn, given my usual sleep schedule. So I haven't been tuning in live, but I have been listening to a lot of the recordings and have enjoyed that very much. So yeah, thank you all for being here today. Today I'll be telling you about some very recent work done in collaboration with two postdocs at Stanford, Matteo Ippoliti and Tibor Rakowski. This work was really led by them, and it's in the series of papers, one that we posted to the archive just last week and one that was published earlier this year. And the subject of the talk will be novel entanglement, new types of entanglement phases and phase transitions in a class of non-unitary circuits that we obtain via space-time duality. Okay. So very, very briefly, you know, of course, this work is situated within the context of this much larger program in many body physics over the last decade or so, where, you know, breakneck developments in the development of designer quantum simulators across a variety of platforms, ranging from ultra-cold atoms to Rydberg atoms, trapped ions, superconducting qubits. You know, this is a picture of Google's Sycamore chip. Have furnished new platforms for many body experiments with unprecedented levels of quantum coherence, control, and measurement capabilities. And what these new experiments have done is, what these devices have done is opened up vast new territories to study many body physics in regimes that go well beyond the usual frameworks in condensed matter that typically involve studying low energy or equilibrium properties of time independent Hamiltonians. In particular, there's been this intense focus on the dynamics of out-of-equilibrium many-body systems. And indeed, this is the natural mode of operation for many of these simulators where kind of quench experiments where you can prepare some initial state and time evolve under some kind of many-body dynamics is very natural. And, you know, in so-called analog simulators, you know, such as ultra-cold atoms, the time evolution is generally can be thought of as time evolution under some Hamiltonian, which could be possibly time dependent, but it's a Hamiltonian that's natural to the physics of the problem. For instance, you know, it's a Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian or the Fermi-Hubbard Hamiltonian, depending on what system you're looking at. And you can do quench experiments under these and probe all sorts of new types of physics. Or more recently, you know, with the development of digital quantum simulators, we have direct access to the physics of quantum circuits. Okay, so there in this mode of operation, you generally imagine preparing some initial state, acting on it with unitary circuits that are drawn from some gate set, making measurements for quantum control or for just making measurements. And then you get some output state whose properties you can examine, right? And indeed, a lot of the focus on in the community on the experimental side has been on the physics of how to actually make these devices, how to make them quantum coherent, how to extend their lifetimes, how to extend their coherence times, how to build qubits with low error rates, right? But for us as theorists, there is this really interesting question of not just how to make these devices, but what to do with them, right? And indeed, the idea is that, you know, now that we're extending beyond this kind of traditional framework for condensed matter experiments where we probe equilibrium or near equilibrium properties of many body systems through either transport or scattering experiments to these new kinds of quantum circuit experiments where an experimenter can act with various gate sets, make measurements, use those measurements to influence what other gates to act. You know, in this new space of these quantum circuit experiments, what new phenomena can be probed that we couldn't probe as easily in these traditional experiments. Okay, so that's a broad question. And indeed, this effort has already given us a lot of insight into very foundational questions that really go back to the inception of quantum statistical mechanics or quantum mechanics, but have only been really sharpened over the last decade or two. You know, these involve things like thermalization in isolated quantum systems, many body localization, quantum chaos. We're asking about the usual program in condensed matters to think about universal phases and phase transitions of many body systems. But when considering the dynamics of quantum systems, you can ask, what are new types of dynamical phases that you could get that may otherwise be forbidden by the strictures of equilibrium thermodynamics? And perhaps most interestingly, we're also thinking of new types of order parameters beyond just correlation functions already with topological order, we think of souped up order parameters, but now experiments are getting to the point where they can directly probe properties such as the quantum entanglement of states or the quantum complexity of a given circuit. Okay, so in this talk, I want to specifically talk about new types of dynamical entanglement phases and phase transitions that we get in non-unitary circuits. This is a particular class of non-unitary circuits that we'll obtain via space-time duality. I'll give you a very brief review of entanglement dynamics and phase transitions, what we know about this in very various contexts. And then I'll tell you about I'll explain what space-time duality is. And indeed, this is a route to getting non-unitary circuits that we started thinking about for two reasons. The first is that there's an experimental motivation to this. When probing these kinds of new dynamics in non-unitary circuits, one encounters what's known as the post-selection problem in needing to post-select over measurement outcomes. I'll describe this later. And these non-unitary circuits, what we showed in this paper earlier last year, is they give us a way to either completely solve in certain settings or greatly ameliorate this post-selection problem. So there is an experimental motivation to making these circuits. But there's also an analytic motivation because the space-time duality, in these classes of non-unitary circuits that people have looked at, analytically tractable circuits are still few and far between. So the space-time duality actually gives us an analytic handle that allows us to bootstrap some of our understanding about how unitary dynamics works to say new things about non-unitary circuits. Okay, and what I'll tell you, because this is only interesting if you get new things that we didn't get already previously, and what we'll find is that we get new types of steady state phases with different types of entanglement scaling. We get phases with logarithmic and volume loss scaling, just as you may get in under unitary evolution. But we actually also get phases with what's known as fractal entanglement scaling. So here the entanglement scales as some fractional power of the subsystem size, which is a possibility that generically just doesn't show up in under unitary dynamics, where one is usually limited to area volume or log laws. Right. And finally, I'll tell you a bit about preparing these states in the lab. Okay. So if there are any questions, please interrupt me at any time. Good. Okay. So what we'll be talking about is the dynamics of quantum entanglement. So we usually have in mind starting with some initial state psi naught, preparing some state psi of t evolved under some types of dynamics. In this case, the dynamics is unitary. If you want to know the entropy of a subsystem A, you prepare the reduced density matrix on A, and then using this, you can get all the different Rényi entropies. And as we know, if the Rényi entropy scales as the volume of subsystem A, then this is known as a volume law. If it's with the perimeter, it's an area law. And if it scales as a logarithm, then that's a log law. And these are the typical outcomes that you can get if you're studying ground states of many body systems or eigenstates of many body systems, or even quench dynamics. Okay, but when studying dynamics, generically, unless your system is localized or otherwise special in some way, generically what you get is ballistic growth of entanglement. So if you start with an unentangled product state, the entanglement grows linearly in time with some entanglement velocity VE. And then if you're looking at the entropy of some finite subregion A, this will eventually saturate. And the saturation value is generically to a thermal volume law phase. This means that the saturation entropy scales with the volume of the subregion. This is in one dimension. That's why it's only an L and not an L to the D there. And the coefficient of this entropy is the thermodynamic. If you're looking at the von Neumann entropy, that's the thermodynamic entropy density, right? Because in a thermalizing system, the von Neumann entropy density at late times has to agree with the thermodynamic entropy, okay, which is extensive. So this is the usual scenario for thermalizing quantum systems. But there is a way in even within the context of unitary dynamics to get something different from this picture, right? And in particular, if we go across the many body localization phase transition, what we know based on a lot of work, which I guess I didn't put references for, is that in the many body localized phase, you do get growth of entanglement, and it's unbounded growth of entanglement in an infinitely large system. But this entanglement grows very slowly. Okay, so in particular, it only grows as a logarithmic time. And then the value to which it saturates, either in a finite system or if you're looking at a finite subregion, is a volume law. But it's a non-thermal volume law in that the entropy density in this final state is generally going to be much less than the thermodynamic entropy density that corresponding to the energy density of the initial state. Okay, so for many body localized systems, you have slow growth of entanglement to a non-thermal volume and saturation to a non-thermal volume law state. On the other side of the of this localized to thermalizing phase transition, in the thermal phase, you know, by definition, the late time states saturate to a thermal volume law, but the growth of entanglement in time can actually be sublinear. Okay, so in particular, when you're just on the other side of the MBL to thermalizing phase transition, due to rare Griffiths effects, you can have all sorts of you can have regions of your sample where the entanglement growth is bottlenecked. And the entanglement grows very slowly across these regions, which on net gives you a kind of subballistic growth of entanglement. Okay, and this transition from subballistic growth to logarithmic growth is a sharp phase transition in the dynamics of these many body systems. Okay, so localization is one way to get something different from the usual scenario of ballistic growth and thermal volume laws. Okay, much excitement over the last couple of years, and I know that there have been many talks on this in this seminar series already, has been on non-unitary circuits. Okay, so this is adding in the element of making measurements, which is again a natural part of the toolkit when thinking of these digital quantum simulators. And the idea is that, you know, you can again start with some initial state and evolve it in time, acting on it with unitary gates or projective, local projective measurements that are made at some rate P. And the key point here is that if you consider individual quantum trajectories, what that means is that you start with some state, you make a particular series of measurements, but then you consider the state for that record of measurements, okay? So as you go along, you get a particular record of measurements. So if you're making measurements in the Z basis, you know, this is some sequence of up, down, up, down, up, down measurements. But if you don't average over those measurements and consider the state corresponding to that particular measurement record, and you look at that state at late times, this isn't really a particular, because these circuits are random in time, there isn't a single steady state, but there is an ensemble of states for which the entropy looks like it saturates to a value, right? To a specific value. So it's, if you're plotting the entropy versus time, it looks like you've reached some kind of steady state, but there isn't actually a single unique steady state. It's like, it's a property of the ensemble. right? And in these systems, what was shown by various groups a couple of years ago, specifically Matthew Fisher's group and Adam Nahum's group, is, or not Adam Nahum's group, but Brian and Adam, is that you can, you know, as you tune the measurement rate, you get a phase transition between a non-thermal volume law phase for low measurement rates. So this is again a volume law phase where the entropy density is less than the maximal entropy density possible, but then you also have interesting corrections here that are not corrections that you would expect in any kind of thermal state. Okay, so these are volume law entangled states, but they're not states that show up in any kind of thermodynamic context. But as you ramp up the measurement rate, the idea is you're just decohering your system more and more, and you end up with area law steady states. Okay. So that's a broad summary of this portion, right? So across this ETH to MBL phase transition, there's a transition both in the steady state scaling properties and in the growth of entanglement. For non-unitary circuits, people have generally just focused on the steady state scaling properties in space. And there you get this, you go from a volume law to an area law and a log law at a transition that's generally described by a CFT. Okay, so this was a state of understanding about 2 years ago. Since then, there have been a variety of papers that have looked at non-unitary dynamics in various different contexts. Okay, so once you expand your system to go from studying only unitary dynamics to non-unitary circuits more generally, you know, we're not limited to just doing unitary gates with local projective measurements, but you know, you can add in various kinds of symmetries. You can look at measurement-only models. You can do all sorts of things. You know, I've just listed four papers here for each of these four figures, but there have been many, many works in the last 2 years. And what these works have found is that you can get much richer phase diagrams, right, in the properties of these steady states. So if you think of these steady states as characterizing some kinds of dynamical phases, you can get steady states with different properties characterized by symmetries that you may build into your dynamics, or you can get different steady states based on entanglement properties. Okay, and the non-unitary circuits that I'll be telling you about today, the space-time dual circuits, is a different way of making a new class of non-unitary circuits. And the big punchline will be that the steady states that we get in this manner give you a new type of entanglement scaling that doesn't occur naturally in unitary systems, namely this kind of fractal entanglement scaling. Okay, good. So I'm going to now start by telling you what space-time duality is. Any questions so far? Okay. So so to understand space-time duality, let's start at the level of just a single gate. Okay, so this is a gate which is unitary when time goes from bottom to top. Okay, so if you think of it as having two input legs, I1 and I2, acted upon by this gate, and two output legs, okay, then that's a unitary object there. But now I can just rotate the arrow of time and view the same gate sideways so that my input legs are O1 and I1 and they come in from the left, and my output legs are O2 and I2 and they go in from the right and they come out at the right. Okay, so if I do this rotation, if I do this transmutation between space and time, or this rotation of this arrow of time, generically what I end up doing is also switching between unitarity and non-unitarity. Okay, so there are very special classes of circuits where the circuit looks unitary in both the time-like and the space-like direction. These are the so-called dual unitary models that have been studied quite a lot recently in the context of quantum chaos. But generically, the answer is that you get a non-unitary evolution when viewed sideways. Okay, the simplest example of this is, imagine that your unitary evolution is just the identity. Okay, so that's the matrix when viewed with I1, I2, O1, O2 as the as the inputs and outputs. And pictorially, you know, this identity just looks like two legs of the circuit because, you know, these two inputs come in, nothing happens to them, and they go out, right? But now when you flip it on the side, you end up permuting these different rows and columns. And what you end up getting once you do this permutation is a projective measurement onto a specific bell state, that's this B plus, which is the up, up plus down, down state on these two qubits, okay? And when viewed sideways, it looks like you have these two qubits coming in. You project them onto this bell state, and you bring out this, and you then create this other, and then you output this other bell state. Okay, so the simplest unitary evolution that you could think of, which is the identity, is actually dual to a force projective measurement onto an entangled bell state of these two qubits. Okay. In general, the dualized gates need not enact forced measurements. Generally, you can get weak measurements, which are drawn from some kind of POVM set, okay? But that's not super important for what we'll be talking about. What's more important is that the measurement is forced. There is no randomness in the measurement outcomes, okay? So the unitary that you were looking at from bottom to top was deterministic. So the matrix that you look at from left to right is also deterministic, okay? So this is the key point that will allow us to ameliorate a lot of this this post-selection problem, which has to do with the randomness of measurement outcomes, which requires you to generally, if you make measurements in a lab, you get some random outcome drawn by Born probabilities. You don't control what that outcome will be at the outset. But in these circuits, when viewed sideways, it's like doing non-unitary evolution, but without this randomness of measurement outcomes. Okay, and this is what will allow us to engineer cheaper kind of non-unitary evolution without with this post-selection problem ameliorated. Okay, so. Good. So this was space-time duality at the level of an individual gate. Let's now, you know, build this up to a full circuit. So we have this big unitary circuit. These carrots denote the direction of unitary time. So unitary time will always go from bottom to top. So in the general scheme of things, you know, you imagine preparing some input state, running it under your unitary circuit, and getting some output state out. Now we are going to run the circuit sideways. So you imagine preparing some input state on this time-like slice of your circuit. Okay, you evolve it under the circuit viewed sideways, and you get an output state on the time-like slice of the circuit again. Okay, and our goal is going to be to study the entanglement properties of this output state, and we'll get different types of scaling behaviors in the entanglement properties of this output state. Okay, and just one more detail is that it has to do with boundary conditions, which I won't stress on very much in this talk, but we had to work out carefully in the paper for various reasons. But essentially what you can already see is that, you know, the boundary conditions for the general unitary evolution live on these time-like slices, okay? So these, if you select some input and output state, these end up being spatial boundary conditions for the unitary evolution. And likewise, if you have some input and output states for the unitary evolution, those end up being boundary conditions for this non-unitary dual evolution, okay? In the talk, I'll always use these tilde variables to refer to the dual non-unitary evolution. Okay, our main goal is that, you know, we have this duality that switches space and time, and unitarity and non-unitarity, and the idea is, can we use this duality to get new phenomena? Okay, and the motivation for doing this is, you know, we know that we have this rich variety of phenomena that we can get for unitary circuits, for unitary time evolution. And the question is, you know, under this duality, does this give a similarly rich set of phenomena that you can get for the non-unitary duals, right? And this is not obvious at the outset, right? Because this looks like some weird kind of, I don't know, it's like a weird kind of analytic continuation between space or time or real and imaginary time. And it's not obvious at the outset that asymptotic properties in one direction have anything to do with asymptotic properties in the other direction. But actually we find that there is a large degree of analytic control that we can get in this problem, so that we actually can relate what we know about unitary evolution to the outcomes of the non-unitary states. And then in addition to that, just like is usually the case in dualities, you know, you can take something pretty boring and get something new and interesting out of it, right? Like you can get topological order by dualizing a boring paramagnet. So likewise, the dual description for this non-unitary circuit can show you new types of properties that are not common in unitary circuits. Okay, and while this is a program much more generally, for the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus just on entanglement properties. Okay, good. So if I want to look at entanglement in space-time dual circuits, the idea is, again, you know, my dual space is going that way. My dual time goes from left to right. So the final state that I prepare lives in this time-like slice. And I want to know the entanglement between some region A of size L twiddle and its complement A bar of size L bar minus L twiddle bar. Okay. And in particular, what I'll want to know is if I've run the circuit sideways for long enough so that this entanglement entropy reaches some kind of saturation value, then how does that steady state value scale with the subsystem size L twiddle? Okay. That'll be one central question. And this is to be contrasted with the usual entanglement cut where time runs from bottom to top and you ask for the entanglement between A and A bar, which live on this space-like slice. Okay. Since this is a long talk, I will get time to discuss some of our results in detail, but I want to just give you a preview or a summary of what we find. Okay. And The upshot is that let's start with thinking about a family of unitary models, okay? And by tuning the nature of the unitary dynamics, as we were discussing previously, you can get a whole variety of rich behaviors for how the entanglement grows in time, right? So in an MBL model, it grows logarithmically. In a thermalizing Griffiths model, it grows subballistically. In a chaotic model, it grows ballistically. And then in the so-called maximally chaotic dual unitary models, it actually grows ballistically with the maximum possible entanglement speed, which is just one. And on the other extreme, in an Anderson localized system, there is no asymptotic growth because it just saturates to an area law, right? So there's no prolonged growth of entropy. Okay, so these are this is how entanglement grows in time in the unitary direction. What we'll find is that we can actually, you know, previously I had showed you that you have unitary evolution in MBL and that can give you these kinds of entanglement phase transitions, and non-unitary evolutions can also give you these entanglement phase transitions. Here we actually directly relate both problems under this duality, okay? And what I'll show is that the space-time duals of these unitary evolutions, So now the picture is that, you know, you're running the circuit sideways. I won't discuss this, but actually we find that the entanglement growth is always ballistic in the dual circuit. So it's not a direct, you know, not every aspect of it matches up, and that'll be important. But the this entanglement in the dual circuit grows ballistically and saturates to some steady state value. And it's the spatial scaling of the steady state values that inherits some of its behavior from the growth in time of the unitary evolution. Okay, so in particular, you know, the log growth of entanglement in time in the MBL phase ends up giving you a spatial logarithmic scaling of entropy in the dual non-unitary circuit, and this sub-ballistic growth of time in the thermalizing Griffiths phase gives you a fractal entanglement growth where the entanglement scales as L to the alpha with alpha being between 0 and 1. Okay. So that's the that's one big upshot, that the growth of entanglement in time in the unitary direction is related in some way to the, or is related in a very direct way to the spatial scaling of steady state entanglement in time in the non-unitary direction. But this is not the full story. It's not just a simple mixing of space and time. As I'll show you, there's actually an important correction that comes from, we'll map the problem to a unitary evolution with the boundary dissipation. And what this does is it gives you important logarithmic corrections in your entropy. Okay, so for instance, the steady state scaling is not just VEL twiddle in space, but it has this logarithmic piece, which makes this a non-thermal volume law entangled state. But this log also is important for other reasons that I'll get to later. And what this further implies is that in models where you would think that the dual should just give you an area law, right? So if you dualize an Anderson localized system, you would think that that naively you just get an area law model. You just get something with area law entanglement. But actually, because of this additional twist that I'll tell you, this actually gives you something with logarithmic scaling. And in fact, you can prove that in these dual circuits, generically, you never get an area law phase. They're very fine-tuned cases where you can get an area law, but generically, you never get area law. So you get log laws, fractals, and volume laws, but not area laws, okay? Good. So now I'm going to move on to how we get entanglement in these dual circuits by mapping. So this is the key piece of physics that will give us a lot of analytic tractability. You know, this slide is the main summary of our results. But then I'm now going to delve into how we actually get these results. So are there questions at this point?
Vedika, so for integrable dynamics, I guess you would also expect log L for the rotated steady state. Is that right?
Well, it depends on what type of integrable dynamics, right? Because even for free fermions, the growth of entanglement in time can be ballistic, right? You just have this quasi-particle picture. So the duals of that will give you volume laws more generally, but then with some corrections, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions?
When Rydberg atoms are highly excited, logic gates are formed. How is it possible? Quantum gates are basically formed.
Sorry.
So what's the reason?
I didn't understand. I couldn't hear you very well.
When Rydberg atoms are excited, quantum gates are formed. How?
Your voice is breaking up. Maybe you can put the question in chat and I can come back to it. All right. Okay. So now let me get into some technical weeds. Okay. So as I said, you know, we want to study the entanglement between A and A bar on this time-like slice. This is a summary slide of the mapping that I'll describe in a few different slides that'll follow. But the upshot is that the entanglement between A and A bar, or the information shared between A and A bar, is isometric to the information shared between A and B in the limit that L twiddle goes off to infinity. Okay, so if you imagine that you're running that you're running an infinitely large dual circuit and then probing the subregion, the entanglement of some subsystem in that infinitely large dual circuit, then in that limit, this entropy between A and A bar is isometrically encoded into the entropy between A and B. And what that allows us to do is actually elide this whole portion of the circuit, which is running for very long, for so long, and only look at this small portion. Well, it doesn't have to be small, but only look at this limited portion of the circuit where You run L-twiddle dual gates or L-twiddle dual qubits for a time that's T-twiddle, okay? And now you can view this object just as a tensor network with you know these legs sticking out, and you can ask for the entropy between the legs defined by A and the legs defined by B, okay? As a tensor network, you can do that. So in order to do that, what you do is you make two copies of the state. You trace out A, I could trace out B, it's equivalent, right? But this act of tracing out A actually ends up looking like boundary decoherence, like you're subjecting your system to a depolarizing or a decoherent channel at the boundary of your of space. Okay. So ultimately what you end up getting is that if you want the entropy at some time t twiddle of a region of size L twiddle in the limit that the rest of this system has gone off to infinity, then this is related to a problem of unitary evolution subject to boundary decoherence. Okay, so this actually looks like the entropy of this unitary circuit run from bottom to top, but with this additional decoherence at the edge. Okay, so you now run a unitary circuit for a time t L twiddle, and the unitary circuit has a size capital T twiddle. Okay, but this is not just normal unitary. If you were just running unitary evolution and you started with some type of pure state, you would end up with a pure state, right? And you would not get any entropy. But the fact that you have some growth in entropy is coming from this decoherence at the boundary there. Okay, I'll unpack this in the next few slides. Okay, so that's our problem, right? We have A and we have B. They live on these time-like slices. We want the entropy between them. Let me do a small simplification and define my subsystem B to be not just the qubits that live on this time-like edge, but also the qubits on the top boundary. Okay, and this is a simplification that becomes exact for when this L twiddle goes to infinity, and we worked out various details for this in various appendices. Okay, so with this simplification made, we can take the qubits that live on this time-like slice, and I'll go through this in more detail later in the talk and in the last section. But for now, believe me that you can. It's easy to see that these are just swap gates. These are unitary swaps, and you can take the qubits that lived on that time-like slice, and by enacting a bunch of different swap gates, you can actually teleport that state to this space-like slice. Okay, so then your region B goes from being this weird cut to living entirely on the top region, but with some extra ancilla qubits and some swap gates added. Okay, and now again, viewed as a tensor network, we want the entanglement between this subregion A and this other subregion B. But when you want the entropy of between two regions A and B, if you make unitary transformations on B alone, right, that doesn't change the entropy between A and B. So indeed, in fact, we don't need to. So indeed, so S of rho B is the same as S of rho B, U dagger B, U B. So this whole portion of the circuit, which is making unitary evolution on B alone, can just be elided. Okay. So then we get back to what I was saying earlier, that we can consider to get the entropy of subregion A, we can look at this much smaller tensor network. And for this much smaller tensor network, we can look at the entropy of A, which would be the same as the entropy of B. And we actually find it more convenient to think of the entropy of B, which is obtained by looking at the density matrix and tracing out A. Okay, good. So when you get this density matrix that's obtained by tracing out A, what we usually do is make two copies of the system, that's the bra and the ket for the density matrix, and then the trace out A. Okay, so this tracing out of A can alternatively be viewed as a kind of depolarization, an edge depolarization that acts on the system. Okay, so at every cycle, what happens is that you trace over this one qubit here, right? And then you bring in a fresh qubit in a completely mixed state, right? So this is a fully depolarizing channel at the boundary. And the point is that if we now think of unitary evolution on this whole system subject to boundary decoherence, it's the boundary decoherence that takes you from a pure system, pure state on the whole subsystem to a mixed state, okay, when under this unitary evolution subject to boundary decoherence. And the entropy of this mixed state is what we're after. And in particular, the entropy of region A evolved sideways ends up being related to the entropy of the mixed state of the full system, okay, evolved under unitary evolution, subject to this kind of boundary decoherence. So that's the summary slide that we had earlier. Okay, any questions on this part? Okay, a different way to look at what we're doing is indeed what, you know, is this mapping to, is this trick of teleportation, which is you take, you know, you had this tensor network between A and B, but by enacting these different swap gates, we can move A to this space-like slice. And then again, you can view this as just ordinary unitary evolution. But now look at the unitary evolution has the system that you would have normally unitarily evolved with on the left half, but the right half is just a series of swap gates, okay? So the main difference between unitary evolution on the whole system, and now you want the entanglement again between A and B, okay? So this is just the usual entanglement cut that you're used to, but the key difference is that you end up with this non-trivial evolution on one, or with this trivial evolution on one half of the system. And information that crosses this cut, you know, this is just a series of swap gates, there's no scrambling, it just gets radiated away to infinity and never re-enters the system, okay? So coming back to this summary picture, you know, when we were thinking of unitary dynamics for a particular class of models, you know, you had in mind unitary gates that acted everywhere in the system. You got to some steady state and you asked for the entropy between A and B. What we've done is we've mapped the problem of thinking about non-unitary evolution to this kind of souped up unitary evolution with boundary decoherence, which in turn can be viewed as unitary evolution, where on one subsystem of interest, you act with the unitary gates that defines your system, but on the other subsystem, you just act with swap gates. And now you ask for the entropy between A and B in this type of evolution, okay? And this already gives you some intuition for why these problems are related. What you know is that, you know, there's an operator spreading view of entanglement dynamics that you can invoke, and the idea is that the entropy of some subregion B is going to be, you can start with some density matrix, you can expand it in Pauli strings, and the entropy of some region B is going to be given by the Pauli strings that live entirely within region B. So as you subject your system to these dynamics and your strings grow and they cross over between A and B, then they no longer contribute to your density matrix and its entropy increases. So the difference between this circuit and this one is that in the bottom circuit, once a Pauli string has grown to cross between these two subregions, it can never shrink back. Whereas under unitary evolution, you know, the string can grow and then shrink back, okay? But if your system is chaotic, then this isn't a big difference, okay? Because this process by which strings shrink is very rare anyway. So that's why it just gives you this weak logarithmic dependence. But in non-chaotic circuits where your strings don't grow very strongly, this boundary decoherence gives you the dominant effect. Okay, so this was a technical point for people who spend a lot of time thinking about circuits. If that went too fast, don't worry about it. Okay, good. So now in the next few minutes, I just want to briefly go through these different examples in turn. So Good. So if we start with Floquet-Anderson localized circuits, okay? So this is where you have exponentially localized non-interacting orbitals. And if you start with some initial state, time evolve it, you saturate to an area law entanglement, okay, under unitary evolution. But what this edge decoherence does is, you know, if you have this edge decoherence, it affects all the orbitals, and each orbital decoheres in some time, which is given by, you know, how strongly this edge decoherence acts on that orbital. And indeed, you know, if the orbitals that are further away in space have exponentially smaller, are influenced exponentially less by this boundary decoherence, and they take exponentially longer to get decohered. Okay, so indeed, each orbital contributes one bit of mixed state entropy as it gets decohered, but it takes a time that is logarithmic in time because of this exponential tail of that orbital. Okay, so the space-time dual steady state gives you this logarithmic entropy with some non-universal coefficient that has to do with the localization length of your problem. Okay, so there's no area law in the circuit, and indeed, even though this is a logarithmic entropy, we don't believe that it's critical in the way of showing CFT scaling or anything like that. Okay. Good. So this was the crispest example of why what we're doing is not just an interchanging of space and time. Okay, because if you were just naively interchanging space and time, you would have expected an area law, but actually we get a log law. Okay. Next, if I look at Haar random circuits, is that a question or
something? No, madam.
Just unmuting. Okay. Good. So next, let's look at Haar random circuits, which is a model for completely chaotic evolution, right? I should have said earlier that, you know, you can have particular unitary Floquet circuits that can give you the full range of values from MBL to thermalizing, which can show you these different types of entanglement scalings, and you can look at their duals. But we find it easier to just, we have more control analytically if you just think of toy models representative of each kind of phase of the unitary evolution. So in particular for the chaotic model, it's easier to think of just Haar random unitary circuits, which of course give you ballistic entanglement dynamics. So for the Haar random circuits, if you look at the average purity, which corresponds to an annealed average of the entropy, this is something that this paper from a few years ago studied in a lot of detail by mapping the problem to a random walk. Okay, so you can take this calculation for the purity of the system, Haar averaged over all your different unitary gates, and you can map it to a random walk problem. And this is a random walk of a domain wall where, you know, the subsystems that you care about, the subsystems A and B, essentially end up defining a boundary condition for the domain wall at the end of time. So there's a domain wall between your subsystem A and your subsystem B. I'm hiding a lot of details here. You know, each of these boxes actually is like four copies of your circuit because you have U star twice, okay, and then this domain wall between, you know, these colored dots, which are like plus spins, and these open circles, which are like minus spins. It's like an effective Ising model having to do with how the legs on these four copies get paired up. So I'm hiding all of those details, but the point is that under regular unitary evolution, under Haar random circuits, if you want to know the entropy between A and B, you can map it to an effective problem of random walks for a domain wall. The boundary condition of the domain wall is fixed by your subsystem. These are A spins, these are B spins. And at every step, the domain wall has equal probability of moving left or right. Once you if you follow this through, you end up getting that your entanglement grows ballistically, and this entanglement velocity can be analytically derived, and it only cares about the local Hilbert space dimension of your qubits. Okay, so in our problem, you know, we use this mapping to boundary decoherence. So as I was saying, you know, we're looking at the entropy of the entire system subject to the boundary edge decoherence. Okay, so that's why for us the domain wall boundary conditions is the whole system is, this is now again unitary evolution. This is the boundary decoherence. The whole system is on one side. And then we have this the domain wall boundary condition is right there between, you know, just the final qubit, which is subject to the boundary decoherence. And the main upshot is that instead of having just a regular random walk, we end up with a random walk with a partially absorbing boundary condition, which comes from this edge decoherence. Okay. And this probability loss due to the absorbing boundary wall, we can basically relate it to the survival probability of this domain wall executing this random walk. And this ends up giving you this square root of L type correction, which shows up very naturally in you know, if you run something for time t, what's the survival probability of this random walk? This is that in the dual picture. But then once you take a log, this square root of L twiddle here is what gives you this universal one half prefactor for your logarithmic correct, gives you a logarithmic correction with this universal one half prefactor. Okay, whereas the leading order piece actually ends up being exactly the same. Okay, so good. So this is actual numerics showing this. We could do these on very large sizes because we can use the property of two designs so that for the annealed average of a Haar random circuit can be exactly calculated by just doing Clifford circuits. And what we find is that, you know, to leading order, indeed, it looks like the entropy, this is the subsystem steady state entropy scaling with subsystem size. It looks like it follows this volume law. But then if you subtract out this analytically known entanglement velocity, you see a very nice one half log L correction. Okay. And I should point out here that this subleading log correction is different from a log correction that shows up in these hybrid unitary measurement circuits, where this paper showed that generically it actually has a three halves log L is a universal number, and this three halves was derived on very very general grounds from the StatMech picture in Matthew Fisher's group last year. But the StatMech picture is actually not applicable to our problem because that picture is very isotropic between space and time. Whereas for us, we have this big anisotropy between a time-like direction, which is unitary, and a space-like direction, which isn't, okay? So this points to a different kind of non-thermal universal volume law phase. And it's very interesting to ask about how this volume law phase might be connected or you know, how this may be related, the properties of this may be related, if at all, to these other non-thermal volume law phase that shows up in unitary measurement circuits. Okay. Finally, let me tell you very briefly about how this fractal and entropy scaling shows up. So, you know, as I was saying, this fractal entropy scaling comes from dualizing unitary dynamics with entanglement bottlenecks that give you subballistic growth of entanglement. You can get this by looking at an MBL model on the thermal side of the MBL phase transition. But actually, we can use a model for this that directly tries to get at this. We can use a random circuit model that directly tries to get at this bottlenecking physics that was proposed by these authors recently. Okay, and the idea is that in this random circuit model, you can put in the bottlenecks by hand. Okay, so you have a model of unitary evolution where gates act on every bond at some rate, and what you can do is that, you know, for every bond, you decide some rate at which unitary gates act on that bond. And this is a very broad distribution of rates. It's a power law distribution. Okay. So what you have is these weak links where gates act very rarely. And then you have these strong links where gates come down very, very frequently. Okay. And then across space, you have this broad distribution of rates. And under these conditions, these authors showed that the entanglement entropy grows as this sub-ballistic power law, and this power is obtained as a function of the of you know, your probability distribution of bottlenecks. Okay, so when you look at the circuit in the dual picture, what ends up happening is that, remember how we said that identities, you know, so in a column where you have a bunch of identities, you know, if you're only acting with the unitary gate infrequently, you're acting with identity for the rest of the time. But now once you dualize it, remember that the dual of the identity was this projective measurement, okay? So if I'm viewing this in the dual picture, then what ends up happening is I told you I'll never switch the direction of space and time, but I actually did that for this one slide. So now this is actually dual. This is an old picture that I haven't updated. This is how you should view the dual evolution. And you see that for the dual evolution, these bottlenecks end up looking like these catastrophic events where most sites end up getting measured. Okay. So in time, you end up with this randomness in time where you have lots of gates that act, and then you have gates where, then you have layers in time where you have lots of different measurements being made, okay, which are dual to this identity. And this is what gives you this kind of fractal scaling of entanglement entropy. Indeed, you know, so, you know, as we tune this parameter A, we can get the entropy of all these different subregions, right? And we can see how they scale with their subsystem size, and they compare fairly well with the analytic prediction from this formula a couple of slides ago. But notice that this is now a steady state with spatial scaling of entropy, which is this fractional power. Okay. And we called it fractal entanglement scaling and not just fractional, because the entire probability distribution actually collapses in this self-similar form, right? So it's not just that's what we mean by fractal. Okay. So these are these new steady states that we get with this kind of entanglement scaling that's not typical for unitary models. Okay, in the last couple of minutes, I just want to briefly talk about how we actually prepare these states in the lab. Okay, as I've been saying all this while, you know, we have some input state on the left and some output state on the right. This output state lives on a time-like slice, which to an experimentalist is weird, right? Even if you're an experimentalist working on digital quantum simulation, you know, you have in your toolkit different unitary gates. You don't necessarily know how to get this state on this time-like slice, okay? And you know, I could have prepared whichever initial state I wanted, but actually I chose to prepare this initial state, which looks like a product of Bell pairs, because that's natural for, you know, if I have open boundary conditions in this time-like direction, that naturally looks like this state with Bell pair initial this Bell pair initial state on this time-like slice. Good. So I have this output state, and what I can do is by again using some ancilla qubits, so I can prepare my entire input state in the lab. So now I am viewing things not sideways, but I'm asking how would an experimentalist with access to quantum gates and unitary gates actually prepare this? And the answer is actually very simple. So you start with an initial state on your original system and the ancilla qubits, which looks like this product of Bell pairs. That again corresponds to having open boundary conditions in your dual circuit. This is a state that can be easily prepared. Now you act with general unitary gates that are in your toolkit. And you act with swap gates, which again, you have access to. And what ends up happening is that the action of these ancilla qubits prepared in these belt states and these swap gates teleport your state from this time-like slice to this space-like slice, which is the usual, state that you would get in a lab. Okay. But now the only last step is that, you know, the actual state that you care about lives on these ancilla qubits, but you also had your system qubits in play. Okay. And to get rid of your system qubits, you need to make one final layer of measurements at the final time step. Okay. And this does give you a post-selection cost because you're measuring, you're making measurements again on these belt states, and you have to throw away all evolutions where your measurement outcome does not result in a belt state. Okay. So this does give you a post-selection cost, but the post-selection cost is only at the only scales as the number of these measurements you have to make only scales as the circuit's boundary, as compared to the usual hybrid measurement circuits where the number of measurements you made scaled with the space-time volume. Okay, so you gain a whole factor of a spatial or a space-time dimension. And because the post-selection cost is exponential in whichever dimension you're looking at, this is actually a big gain. Okay. So what is the post-selection problem? Let me briefly describe that because I haven't exactly done that so far. The point is that anytime I want to prepare, anytime I want to measure entropy or prepare or of some state or measure some property of it that's non-linear in the state, right? And that's important because if I'm average over measurement outcomes, I don't get anything interesting. So everything non-trivial comes from looking at these kinds of non-linear properties. I need to prepare multiple copies of my final state, okay? But quantum randomness of measurement outcomes makes this hard because if I want to consider an individual trajectory, which is so say I'm doing this unitary measurement circuit where I act with unitary gates and measurements, to prepare the same state multiple times, I need the exact same sequence of measurement outcomes. But these measurement outcomes are just drawn randomly with Born probabilities in the usual case where you're just making regular measurements, not these kinds of dual circuits. So to get all these measurement outcomes to agree is an exponential overhead in the space-time volume. Okay, but notice that here we circumvented that exactly entirely because for this entire bulk of the evolution, we're just acting with unitary gates. There are no explicit measurements being made, but we want to view this output gate, you know, on this time-like slice as if it was acting under non-unitary evolution. And the only actual measurement piece that we need to make for this protocol is in the very final step where we have to discard all outcomes that don't give you these belt states on the final step. Okay, so this is a huge gain in this post-selection cost. In our previous paper where we considered these space-time dual circuits, what we showed is that if you want to study what are known as purification dynamics, so instead of studying the entanglement of steady states, you can start with an entirely mixed state and ask about the times it takes to purify, which also gives you sharp transitions, then actually the purification dynamics in these space-time duals can be studied with no post-selection on measurement outcomes at all. And there's a specific protocol for that we outlined. And what we showed here is that if you want to ask about the entanglement of pure states rather than purification dynamics, and the entanglement of states that are steady states of these non-unitary circuits, then you can get those with limited post-selection that scales as the boundary of space-time on the measurement outcomes. Good. So to summarize, I presented to you space-time duality as a physically motivated route to interesting non-unitary circuits with analytic tractability, where this mapping to boundary dissipation allowed us to gain a lot of insight. We found a zoo of equilibrium late time, out of equilibrium late time steady states with all kinds of entanglement scaling, in notably fractal entanglement scaling. And this has, of course, raised a whole host of questions ranging from this nature of this new non-thermal volume law phase with this 1/2 log L correction to duals of, you know, other classes of unitary circuits that are interesting. You know, you can have unitary circuits with all kinds of phase structure. What does that look like in the dual picture? You know, we just focused on entanglement, but there's of course a lot more to do here. And you can ask about, I think you guys heard a talk from Ehud a few weeks ago on how you can view these steady states as ground states of souped up Hamiltonians with souped up symmetries. You know, can we obtain these fractal steady states as ground states of these kinds of generalized Hamiltonians? But much more broadly, we're only, you know, now starting to expand many body dynamics to this non-unitary domain, and there's just infinitely many things to do and lots to discover. So again, I want to thank my collaborators, Matteo and Tibor, who really led this work. And you can find more details here. I should also say, I should have put it on the slide here. There was related work from Tharun Grover to what we did, and that should be available on the archive too.
Okay, thanks, Vedika, for the very nice talk. Maybe I can start with a possibly crackpot question that you're free to ignore if you wish. So I guess nature has some kind of space-time interchange in the interior of a black hole, in some sense, right? And this picture of your edge decoherence is kind of reminiscent of what people have been doing with coupling.
Right.
The space-time to some auxiliary system for the radiation to leak out. I was wondering if there are any, I don't know, if there are any relations between these studies or...
Yeah, so I mean, the words that we use for information being radiated away from the black hole, you know, from the edge, we were thinking of these things. The terminology is similar to that. You know, we were thinking, okay, you model your black hole as some chaotic system, and then you can you have some kind of information that can get radiated out from there, and then you ask about entanglement and page curves and all that. But beyond the similarity in language, I'm not sure we've really sharpened that connection much more than that.
I have a question. In your work, it seemed to me that you have only considered system in one spatial dimension.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult or what would happen if we want to generalize this to higher dimensional space-time, because we know that we have more spatial dimensions than the time dimension, which is only one dimensional.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And there, what would end up happening is that you end up doing the duality between one of your space directions and time. So the rest of your space directions just look unitary, but you do this duality on one dimension.
Right.
Actually, Tharun Grover's paper does that already. And something morally similar, though not exactly similar, was also used in a paper by Aram Harrow's group, where, you know, they were asking this question of how hard is it to simulate a shallow 2D quantum circuit. Okay, so this is
right.
Of course, you know, the central question for supremacy when you think of Google's experiments and so on. And so they had a 2D circuit and it was shallow, meaning that, you know, they only evolved it for a finite amount of time, but then they viewed it in this way where one of the dimensions was made into the pseudo time dimension, and there they got some level of some kind of non-unitarity out of that. So you can generalize this to higher dimensions, indeed.
Okay, so now there are some literatures already.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There's some very recent literature. I think the most direct reference is Tharun's paper, where they look at it for a particular 2D model.
How do you spell the name, Sarens?
Oh, sorry. I will put it in the chat if I can find the chat.
Okay.
There's the chat.
That will be great. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I have a question regarding, so first of all, thanks for the very nice talk. So you interchanged T and X. Mm-hmm. And a priori, I would like ask, would it make sense to not interchange, like do like, this is like a Lorentz rotation, right? But would it make sense to have like a Lorentz rotation, which is only in between? I don't know. So would that give any interesting physics from your point of view?
But in between, you mean like?
So I mean, say you don't rotate X and T like in the diagram that you showed them in the beginning. Mm-hmm. By mm-hmm. 90 degrees, but you right. rotate them by, yeah. I don't know, 45.
Right. No, that could certainly be interesting too. As I was saying, you know, once you start doing these kinds of continuations, it looks like this very broad space of things you can do. And indeed, I think that would be interesting to try. One of the good things about this method is that it we could actually relate the non-unitary dynamics to, you know, well understood behaviors about unitary dynamics. So it gave us this level of analytic control, which was nice and which we haven't really had very much in these non-unitary problems so far. With these more general rotation angles, indeed you would get non-unitary dynamics very, very generally. But I don't know at the top of my head whether you'd get that kind of analytic tractability. You might in some souped up way.
All right, thanks a lot.
Yeah. Kirill?
I've got a question. When you do this duality transformation exchange space and time, you showed that unitary becomes a non-unitary in the new time. What would be the object which is self-dual under such transformation? And what is the entanglement behavior if the evolution is governed by such objects?
Yeah, great. So these are these dual unitary circuits, which people have been studying quite a lot. I'm not sure if there's been a talk on this in this series. So there, indeed, you end up with, when you make this switch, you don't get this extra logarithmic correction. So for dual unitary circuits, this was way... this was here, right? So these dual unitary are circuits which look unitary in both space and time. These actually have a maximum entanglement velocity, which is stuck at T. And when you dualize it, you get a spatial entanglement scaling, which is L twiddle, but with no extra logarithmic corrections. And this comes from the fact that in these dual unitary circuits, actually all your information is always pinned to the light cone. There's actually never any return of there's never these strings that grow and then shrink again. And because that never happens, the changing this from this circuit to this one actually doesn't change the entropy properties. So for dual unitary circuits, you don't get these logarithmic corrections and this boundary dissipation doesn't really do anything.
But does it have to be unitary? I could have a self-dual object which is not unitary.
Right. So this is something that we have been wondering about and I don't have a good answer yet. So I've talked to Matteo about this a few times. Like, you know, can we try to get a non-unitary object which is self-dual and will that teach us anything? I don't know yet, but it's a question.
I see, thanks.
Yeah.
Any other questions for Vedika? If not, let's thank Vedika again for a very nice talk. Oh, there's one more. Yeah, Alex, go ahead.
Oh, hi, Vedika. Thanks for a very interesting talk. So maybe just one more question to sort of...
Alex, you froze.
Circuit, and then you do this transformation, you get something non-unitary. Yeah, that's so can you generically sort of realize it experimentally, or also so you discussed this type of experimental realizations, but I was not sure whether it's so what is, because in general the make some experiment that would correspond to this dual surface, dual circuit with some measurements, and or it's only in some special cases. So what is the
status? Good. So you were breaking up a few times, but I think you were asking, you know, can we actually make some experiments to see this?
So
if I just told you at the level of gates, right? Like, okay, here is a unitary gate. The dual of it is some weird non-unitary matrix, you know. And then if I tell you, you can prepare some initial state and act with this weird non-unitary matrix and get an output state, that's not something that your experimentalist actually has access to. You know, they don't have access to weird non-unitary.
That's exactly my question. So how do you do?
So that's this figure here, right? So in this figure, what I'm showing is that, you know, these yellow gates with the carrots pointing upwards, these are just unitary gates. So you can pick your favorite unitary gates. You can pick the unitary gates which give you MBL or which give you, give you Griffith's physics, whatever you want, okay? And now this input state for the sideways evolution, if you view this input state just as this Bell pair state, this actually just looks like unitary evolution with open boundary conditions, okay? Because if you were just doing open boundary conditions, this is what you would draw on your circuit. You have an identity. You dualize that. That looks like this Bell pair state. So if you want to understand, you know, if I started with this Bell pair initial state, evolved the circuit sideways, and got this output state on this time-like slice, this is the output state, these colored dots that you want to prepare experimentally. But then you can do this kind of teleportation that I was telling you about. So the experimental protocol is at time zero for the unitary time direction, you have your systems qubits, which are prepared in these Bell states. This is doable in the lab. You just act with some gates that make these Bell states. And then you have ancilla qubits. The number of these ancilla qubits is given by the same, by this dimension, okay? Also prepared in these Bell states. Then you act with your normal unitary gates as you would. You act with swap gates like you would. So until this point, there's nothing non-unitary happening. And the experiment is, you know, something Google could do tomorrow, right? And then, you know, at the final step, you get some state that lives on your ancilla qubits. That's actually just each of these swap gates takes you, you know, takes this blue dot and kind of moves it all the way around and brings you there, and then takes the green dot. So the sequence actually just gives you back this output state, but now on this regular slice. And finally, you have to get rid of the system's qubits, and you do that by acting with one set of projective measurements at the final step. And this gives you, this incurs a post-selection cost. But this is a protocol that the capabilities for doing this exist today. There's nothing very special about it, yeah.
So you say you can make a protocol that would really implement.
Yeah. It's sorry, you're frozen. You're frozen, but yes, this is the protocol. You know.
Oh, sorry. So my question was: can you realize dual to any unitary circuit in this way?
It's whatever unitary circuit you put on your gates here, which, you know, I think they're building towards any kinds of, they're rapidly expanding their gate sets in the lab, right? So at least, like, there is a particular Ising model where they already have the gates for that. And by enacting that model on this side, you know, you could realize MBL unitaries or Griffith's unitaries or any of these different unitaries and get these output states with log scaling or fractal scaling and then study them. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, thank you. Yeah.
Maybe one last question from Nikki.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a very naive question, like, just what's the physical meaning of, so when you swap space and time, what's the physical meaning of entanglements in the time, in the dual time direction? So normally in space, it's intuitive, but like for time, how do you understand it physically?
Right. So I think the perspective we're taking is, you know, if you had a non-unitary evolution where you just prepared some initial state, acted on it with unitary gates, made some projective measurements, kept going, right? That's an initial state subject to some type of non-unitary evolution. You get some late time steady states and you want to know the entropy scaling properties of those late time steady states, okay? Now, the whole family of non-unitary circuits that we can consider is vast, right? Like there's nothing which says we only need to consider circuits where you act with unitary gates and enact subject and projective measurements. So here I'm saying, let's consider this different class of non-unitary circuits, which you can view, you know, I drew it in this way where everything was going sideways, but you can view it as you prepared some initial state and you acted on it with these gates, but these gates are these non-unitary operators, which look like they're enacting these forced weak measurements. And then you get a final state and you ask, you know, what does that state look like, right? But it's just natural to view it like this, because then, as I was saying, you know, experimentally, you actually have access to these output states. So it's not just, how do I prepare, what is this weird gate set that an experimentalist can never build? But when you view it this way, you actually can make these states.
I see. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, let's all thank Vedika, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Vedika. Great talk.